Our presentation today is The Past, Present, and Future Labor Movement by Erin Liu. Erin is a prairie-raised student from Madison, Wisconsin. He is currently pursuing a master's degree in labor studies from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. So we're very delighted to welcome him back after a long absence.
Hello. Yes. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Erin Liu. I was raised essentially here, basically from early elementary school through high school. Basically every Sunday was here at Prairie. 6 years ago, I gave my first presentation about the principles of Unitarian Universalism as they applied to Ultimate Frisbee. And now on Labor Day Eve, I'm pleased to share my second presentation, The Past, Present, and Future Labor Movement. I'm going to begin with a brief personal history of my connection to the labor movement, then as short of a history of the entire American labor movement as I can, offer what insights I can into the present struggles of the labor movement, and finally do my best to sell all of you on my vision of the future labor movement. So to begin, my own connection with the labor movement begins here in Madison. In 2011, everyone's favorite governor, Scott Walker, passed Act 10, which slashed the rights of most public sector unions in the state. And that led to my teachers here in Madison shutting down the schools for a few days. My mom took me and my sister downtown on several of those days, and we protested alongside many other Prairie members. And those few days in the winter of 2011 started the ball rolling on my interest in social justice, politics, and building a better world. Years later, at Boise State University, I found myself studying history and minoring in labor studies. My undergraduate thesis was focused on the quest for a union in 1910s and 20s West Virginia. And while at Boise State, I worked as a custodian and joined American Federation of Teachers Local 3536, a small union without a contract trying to build whatever leverage we could in Idaho. My experiences in studies at Boise State led me to pursue a master's degree in labor studies at UMass Amherst, and I was, and I believe technically am, still a member of the fourth oldest graduate union in the country, GEO, the Graduate Employee Organization, one of the several shops in United Auto Workers Local 2322. While I was at UMass, I served on the Local 2322 Joint Council and was briefly a steward for my department. I was a part of a contract escalation campaign and some small new organizing efforts to bring graduate dining hall workers into the union, and I am now in the final months of my degree, just needing to write some papers. So that's my own personal connection to the labor movement, part academic, part lived. And this means that I get to launch into the easy part of the presentation, which is condense over 400 years of labor history into about 6 minutes. That's about what I timed it out to when I practiced. So the history of the labor movement in America is inseparable from the movement of labor, specifically, particularly enslaved Africans into North America. The emerging industrial production in the North was fueled by cotton, tobacco, rice, and indigo grown by enslaved black workers in the South. The Civil War was won in large part by the North due to what can be classified by a general strike of black workers in the South. Many skilled crafts in northern industrial cities formed white-only unions in an effort to block free and freed black workers from entering trades. The first large effort to organize workers interracially came with the Knights of Labor. Founded in the wake of the Civil War, the Knights initially organized across color and craft lines, and the organization grew slowly until the 1880s, when it spiked in membership and power, and peaked in 1886 at about 800,000 members, which was 20% of the working class in the United States at the time. That didn't last long, and there was very soon a precipitous decline in membership. But in the same period, we start to see events like the Great Upheaval of 1877, the 1886 Haymarket Affair, and the 1894 Pullman Strike. And these were among the earliest significant labor actions in the growing industrial economy of the United States. I'm going to specifically touch on the Haymarket Affair because that just a monumental event. It was part of a demonstration for the 8-hour day in Chicago. There was a bombing. It turned violent, and that led to the execution of several radicals. And it kind of like laid the groundwork for the Red Scare. And 1886, May 1st, that became kind of the push for May Day as International Workers' Day, which in turn in the United States led to President Cleveland enshrining Labor Day as the first Monday in September as a way to divert energy away from the international workers' movement. And in the wake of the Knights of Labor, the American Federation of Labor emerged as the preeminent labor organization of the U.S. Backtracking from the Knights of Labor's inclusive racial policy, the AFL endorsed and allowed segregated locals and focused on organizing skilled white men into small craft organizations, by and large. Just past the turn of the century, the Industrial Workers of the World, an anti-capitalist syndicalist union seeking to organize workers into one big union, formed as a radical counter to the conservative AFL. The IWW was a major cultural force in labor. Many of labor's classic songs, like Solidarity Forever, were written by IWW organizers or about IWW-led strikes or actions. The 1910s and 20s, and really the entire labor movement up until like the mid-1930s, was marked by violence. The private police, in the form of Pinkertons or the Baldwin Felts, depending on where you were routinely hired by owners to infiltrate, blackmail, threaten, yada, 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 labor organizers. In particular, mine workers fought bitter battles against the gun thugs of the company. And in many cases, ended up fighting against the National Guard. In 1914, at Ludlow, Colorado, almost two dozen people were killed by anti-union forces. And 7 years later, at the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921, which was the subject of my undergraduate thesis, it took the U.S. Army to put down basically a civil war in Logan and Mingo counties that saw about 10,000, roughly, miners and their supporters basically trying to take over the counties and unionize them by force. And Tuesday is the 103rd anniversary of the ending of the Blair Mountain conflict. So we're in the time period that time of year that the Blair Mountain conflict happened. Anyways, the 1930s, onset of the Great Depression, worker uprisings took new directions. There were general strikes in San Francisco and Minneapolis and Toledo in 1934. Sit-down strikes, the most famous being the 1936-1937 sit-down strike at General Motors, saw workers, instead of like walking out, setting up picket lines, setting perimeters, not letting workers in, they just basically sat down on the shop floor and said, "This is ours now." This was also at the same time as the emergence of the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, which was a split off of the AFL, led primarily by John Lewis and a host of, you know, kind of on the ground level, a lot of socialist and communist organizers that, you know, John Lewis directed and brought in a massive wave of industrial organizing. And that was part because of the National Labor Relations Act, which passed in 1935, which for the first time established a national codified structure for organizing a union, setting up like bargaining. And that's pretty much the framework that we have now. Through the Second World War, there was a bit of industrial peace as major union leaders agreed not to strike to help the war effort. And as a result of that, in 1946, at the end of the war, 4.6 million workers went on strike in that calendar year, which, to put in comparison, 2023, which is kind of a local maximum, the most workers we've seen on strike in quite a few years, saw 470,000. So magnitudes more workers going on strike then. Then as a result of all those strikes, the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act dampened unions' rights under the NLRA, established really the status quo of labor through the modern day. And that also, you know, purged communists. It took away all the rights to do all the fun strikes. You can't do a general strike. You can't do a sympathy strike. Basically, it's the No Fun Act. The 1960s and 70s would see a drive for public sector workers and farm workers who were excluded from the NLRA to be included in unions. In the 1980s, the tide for labor turned as, you know, the Reagan regime pursued deregulation and anti-union measures, the most infamous being the 1981, you know, PATCO strike, which was crushed by Reagan and destroyed a 10,000-person union overnight and set the tone for decades of concessionary bargaining, deindustrialization, loss of union jobs. And to put some of that in perspective, the union density in the United States, around one-third of all public, of all private sector workers in the United States in the mid-1950s were union. I think the number is like 35%. By the end of the 70s, it was at about 25%, and now it's at about 8%, 9%. So about equivalent to what it was in like 1920. So the labor movement in the post-Taft-Hartley period is characterized by an increasingly powerful and increasingly ossified union bureaucracy, a steady decrease in strike activity, and a increased reliance on the electoral efforts of the Democratic Party, as well as a drought of large new organizing efforts. Now, that leads us to the present. Everything I just mentioned is still true. For the most part, but the tide is changing. Last fall, the United Auto Workers struck all three of the big three automakers, which happened pretty much coincided with the SAG-AFTRA and Writers Guild strikes that brought positive attention and like 10% raises to at least 200,000 workers. Major wins that we haven't seen in a long time. Internal reform groups like UAWD, TDU, which is Teamsters for Democratic Union, UAWD is Unite All Workers for Democracy, and Essential Workers for Democracy are taking on union bureaucracy in unions like the UAW, Teamsters, and United Food and Commercial Workers. In particular, the UAWD slate, which included Sean Fain, swept the top leadership of the union and has initiated the beginning of a major structural overhaul of the UAW. The UAW has also been at the forefront of new organizing. Their success in organizing on university campuses has been instrumental in a major wave of graduate student organizing in the last 3 to 4 years. Additionally, the union has turned to take on the non-union auto plants of the South. They were successful at Volkswagen in Tennessee, but recently lost an election at Mercedes in Alabama. But that organizing effort is going to continue over the coming years. The UAW alongside the Teamsters and then Workers United, who are leading the Starbucks union drive, are really setting a new standard for organizing new people into unions in the 21st century. The labor movement has also been faced with the question of their role in the U.S. war machine, and especially the ongoing Israeli genocide of Palestinians. Several major unions like the UAW, among many others, have called on an end to all U.S. military aid to Israel. That being said, the UAW and certain other unions who have not spoken out against it are actively producing weapons that end up in Israel. So, there's still just like a long way to go to depart from a, you know, legacy of over 100 years of happily serving the U.S. military industrial complex. Last piece of the modern labor movement I want to touch on is the organizing efforts at Amazon. Amazon is the second largest employer in the United States behind Walmart and the fifth most valuable company in the world. And I like to call Amazon the General Motors of our time. You know, it's the equivalent of what General Motors was in the 1930s, the by far like the biggest producer, the most adamantly anti-union force out there. And the Teamsters, the largest private sector union in the country, over a million members, have created an internal division and dedicated a lot of money towards organizing at Amazon. And the ALU, the Amazon Labor Union, which won their election a couple years ago at this point at JFK 8 in Staten Island, recently affiliated with the Teamsters. So the fight against Amazon, to me, is going to be one of the defining aspects of the labor movement of the coming years. Okay, and that leads me to what I believe will and should come next in the future labor movement. I would apologize for this section being a little preachy, but it's church. What are you going to do? At the center of the issues facing the modern and future labor movement is capitalism. The manifestation of this system is a dense Gordian knot of sorts, a tangled web of mutually reinforcing histories of oppression and exploitation within which we, you know, we operate and we organize within the context of all which is around us. The symptoms of this knot are many in the labor movement. For example, like the lack of new organizing historically has been driven by like the truly outlandish concept that some workers, generally racial minorities or women, are who are in like unskilled or precarious labor are unorganizable, which is ludicrous, but it's driven by that same like, you know, only some workers deserve rights sort of ethos. The drive of unions towards bureaucracy and stagnant policy behavior is coupled with the political patronage of parties like the Democrats, like the Republicans in certain states. And those parties, for at least the Democrats, for what good they do occasionally, don't answer to the workers. They don't answer to the unions. And the laws which govern labor and unions are carved and crafted to exclude, you know, jobs primarily occupied by Black workers, immigrants, and women. This can be seen, like I mentioned earlier, in how the NLRA specifically excludes agricultural workers, public sector workers, and domestic workers from the protections of the Act. So the task in front of us in the labor movement is to untie this knot and free ourselves from this tangled mess. What that means on the ground, however, is a reimagining of labor strategy. A bold new approach to organizing workers and working class communities is necessary. The labor movement must learn from its historical mistakes, which are plenty, and the labor movement must remember what made its many victories possible. There are certain things I want to pick on as key elements of the future labor movement. The labor movement must be internationalist and it must be multiracial. The old AF of L model of organizing only white skilled workers is not going to cut it. It didn't really ever cut it. And in an era of global capitalism where workers and corporations and capital is flowing all over the borders, there's really no way to organize with a narrow focus on just certain workers. It's got to be everyone. The labor movement can't turn its back on the most exploited, most endangered members of the working class here in the United States and abroad. We need to organize all workers. The labor movement must be democratic. I've said bureaucracy so many times, I'm going to say it more. The bureaucratized labor movement, which has produced a sizable class of those who manage the activities of those in unions rather than a member-led rank-and-file activism, it is kind of the status quo. Bureaucrats are paid in some cases, in like the UFCW and the Teamsters, certain bureaucrats are paid like $250,000, $300,000 a year. Well, the workers that they are supposed to represent are earning, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. So there are needed reforms, certain reforms like one member, one vote, open bargaining, you know, constitutional changes to the union's constitution. We've seen that in Teamsters. We've seen that in the UAW. There's a lawsuit going on in the UFCW to win those things. But in general, we need to be pushing for a labor movement that lets unions members speak for themselves and is driven by the rank and file. The labor movement must act independently in politics. The last century of being tied at the hilt to the Democratic Party has left the labor movement without a political vision of its own. A decisive lack of independent action and political suits go part and parcel with the bureaucratized trade union status quo that I'm talking about. The purge of communists and socialists in the second Red Scare of the 40s and 50s, along with the systematic destruction by the FBI of groups like the Black Panthers and the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, squashed the meaningful impetus for independent action in the centers of American industry. But the ascendancy of groups such as the Democratic Socialists of America and just broadly more interest in socialist and labor activity gives us an opportunity at the current moment that if we choose to take it to build a new independent left-wing political movement that can make real change. And all this points to one main thing. The labor movement must attack the biggest issues of our modern day head on. The labor movement must be political and act in the interests of the working class. The labor movement needs to take on the General Motors of our times, the Amazons, the Walmarts, the Teslas. I believe that orienting our struggle towards those big fights, towards explicitly taking on the structures as a whole, gives us a way forwards. We must build like a rank and file political movement on the shop floor of these companies and put forth the idea rather than these companies dominating our lives that we should have our own lives under our own control. The last moment of my time, I want to point towards something a little bit more concrete. UAW President Sean Fain, who I mentioned earlier, called for all of the unions in the United States to organize their contracts to expire on April 30th, 2028. This provides a legal workaround to the Taft-Hartley you can't organize a general strike thing, and sets the stage for, on May Day of 2028, theoretically, a national general strike. You know, millions of workers going on strike, getting into the streets, and fighting for things like universal healthcare, pensions, an expanded social welfare state. It will take a great deal of organizing between now and April 2028 to make a monumental strike like that happen. But there are murmurs of support through a lot of the mainstream, you know, labor movement. At least one of the teachers' unions, like nationally, has agreed to it. A lot of local labor councils are organizing their local unions to, you know, make sure that everybody's contracts are aligned to end April 30th, 2028. There's work to be done. Basically, it comes down to there's work to be done for those who are willing to do it. If we're able to bring about that strike in 2028, that to me will be the true like rebirth of the US labor movement that we haven't seen since like the 30s and the 40s. The labor movement needs to get there, learn from our past, both the good and the bad, understand our present, and fight like hell for the future. So the task before us is simple. Build a multiracial, democratic, politicized labor movement. Take the fight to the bosses. Take on the Amazons, the Walmarts, the Teslas. Stand in solidarity with workers across the world. And if we manage to do all that, all that's left to do is win. So I'll see you all on the picket lines. Interesting question. I don't think it'll make it truly unnecessary. Because even if everybody's like getting paid, you know, a universal basic income, people are still going to work. There's still going to be people who the companies are going to want us to produce regardless. And if the companies want us to produce, we're going to have to protect ourselves while we're producing. That's kind of just like the baseline of it. Even if we have universal basic income, even if we get like universal healthcare and things like that, there is still the issue of like the shop floor is not going to be a safe place unless we make it a safe place. That, you know, we've seen with like the railroads especially, that the more that you let the companies kind of just do whatever they want, the more that you end up with things like what happened in East Palestine of, you know, chemical spills, people getting forced out of their homes because, you know, there's a chemical spill in like one of the largest waterways in the country getting polluted as a result of that. So as much as I think something like universal basic income or, you know, I'm a big fan of local statistical commissions that set minimum wages locally based on cost of living. That's an idea that I'm a big fan of. That sort of thing, as long as there's people going to work and like having a job somewhere, there's going to be a labor movement. A lot of things. On the radicals point of the Haymarket affair, I said radicals because I didn't want to like go down the laundry list of like there was communists, there's anarchists, there were socialists, there were like a couple of other ists there. The labor capital balance, I don't know if I have any profound thoughts on that. But the police unions thing is another thing that I kind of should have brought up in the like what are the modern tensions of the labor movement, because that is a big thing that like there are certain the SEIU I believe represents a lot of like police and private security, and there's an effort within that union to like get the union to drop those unions because they don't want understandably the, you know, workers who a lot of times spend their entire lives being like terrorized and over policed by these police don't want police unions in the same space as them. I think what related to that, something that's interesting is that in a lot of states like Wisconsin that passed like Act 10 or equivalents, the police were kind of like carved out of that in a niche way of like, oh, you can, we don't want to, there's some political patronage going on there. The police unions, I think, don't need to exist. I'm going to come out and say that I don't think cops are workers, and therefore don't necessarily need a union. I understand that may be controversial. That's my two cents. I have a friend who's in the IBEW. He's an electrician in Idaho, and is going through the apprenticeship program there. He works like a full 8-hour day in the field, and then it's basically like night classes, but it's all paid for by the union. It's all like he doesn't pay anything out of pocket. There is a lot of, apprenticeship programs are still alive and well. I think the robustness of the education has declined, that it's not necessarily like as broad of an education. It's far narrower, like craft, like this is what you need to be an electrician, and less like beyond that. The from my understanding of a lot of unions, the like internal like kind of political popular education aspects of them have declined a little, but there is still a lot of education that is like paid for by the unions, and a lot of my master's program in particular, there a lot of unions give their members scholarships to come through that program. Right to work is a very misleading term. Right to work basically means that certain states have said that if you're a union, it's an open shop, so not everybody who works there has to be in the union. And even if they're not like a dues-paying union member, the union still has like legal liability over them. So if I'm in a shop with all of you, and all of you are dues-paying members, and I'm not, and you know the employer fires me for some reason that I shouldn't be fired for, you and your funds have to legally go to defending me for getting fired. It's basically the free rider law. That it doesn't do anything other than weaken unions, and that's that. There's also a Supreme Court case in like 2016 that made all public sector unions are right to work, so membership isn't automatic. You have to sign up separately, and all of that. So right to work basically just means it's harder to keep a union alive, and that comes with lower wages because the union's not fighting as well to bring everybody's wages up. So on the first thing, that you make a good point that like, yes, there's going to need to be union staff. Union organizers in their like very earliest, like the paid union organizer originated in coal fields because they couldn't get fired. Because instead of like a worker going around talking union and then immediately getting fired, because you could do that at the time, it's just like, wait, we're all paying dues. Why don't we just give some of our dues to this person to come and organize all of us? And like, that's, I'm in favor of that. I think organizers have their place. I think that like there is going to be management of things like who's keeping track of dues and financials and things like that. But there's a difference between there being management and like what we have today is the union bureaucracy, which like you can imagine that in bold with like a big trademark at the end of it. It's like, it's a big thing that is, it's a structural thing in how those bureaucrats have power, how they're paid, how all of that happens, that also, some of it is that that type of like super managerial bureaucrat role becomes less necessary when the workers themselves are more organized. So it's kind of a give and take of like, hopefully you need less like hands-on managerial stuff when, you know, everybody on the shop floor is just informed and talking to each other and there's open communication. And then on the coding thing, that's a hard question. There is some effort. There's a union at Google that is trying to be formed, the Alphabet Workers Union. And it's hard because a lot of people are in those fields are classified as contractors, which exempts them from the protections of the act. And there's also weird stuff in how the act is written. It's like, who's a supervisor, who's a manager, and can supervisors unionize? Because managers can't. And if you're a supervisor, you share some overlap with the managers. But it's like, who is who? And that means that it gives companies a lot of leeway that if somebody's trying to file like a petition for a union, they can say like, well, that includes these people. So you can, it's a legal mess that we haven't gotten all the way through. We're still figuring out if you can like use email, can you use company emails to organize a union is like a legal question that is ongoing. And it depends on who's in charge of the NLRB at any given chance and any given moment. So that is to be determined. What's really fascinating about the modern day is that we have the highest approval of unions like ever in terms of like what's being recorded in polling. 71% of Americans are pro-union, but again, less than 10% are in a union. So to me, it's like there is needed like propaganda and agitation. I think an old adage is like the best organizer is a bad boss, and there's plenty of bad bosses. So that part will kind of take care of itself. The bigger issue to me is like there's all these people who are pro union, and 1 in 10 of them maybe is in a union, and that's an issue. And I think that will come with like getting people used to the fact that like, oh, I can organize one myself. That you don't need to be, you know, some crazy person with a master's degree to organize a union. You can just do it. So the private and public sector unions have always kind of worked together. It's more so like there's a legal division between them of like federal and state employees have different laws governing them than private employees. So like the AFSCME and a lot of like teachers unions and all of that are in like local union federations with private sector unions. It's just a matter of like the laws that govern them are slightly different. Yeah. There was a strike at Boston University, Northeastern. One of the big private Boston universities of their grad students, and in place of, you know, paying the grad students wages, the university started grading undergrads papers with AI. It went horribly, it blew up in their faces, but that has already happened. I think a lot of companies are gonna find out pretty quickly that like some AI works, but a lot of AI does kind of suck. That like a lot of the like generative text-based stuff is fine. But also like there is labor that goes into the AI way further downstream of like the reason that we have these machines that can create images that look like other things is because that there's some like poor kid in like India or, you know, somewhere in Africa who's just sitting at a computer all day getting paid like 2 cents an hour, to like click and identify things of like literally just doing captchas 8 hours a day. That's what fuels AI. So I guess part of it's like, how do we organize those people? And how do we organize the people who are like coding and whatnot, all of this? But I, as much as AI is going to be a pain, I guess I'm somewhat more pessimistic about all of its capabilities that like, I think companies are going to lay a bunch of people off, replace them with AI, realize that AI isn't able to cut it, and then hire back all those people. Cause that's already happened at like a suicide hotline, which is a crazy place to try out AI. Like they fired all their people, replaced it with an AI chatbot. It went horribly. And then they just like, okay, now we need to hire people again. And I don't want that to have to happen over and over again, but I think it will.